Now broadcasting in English.
You're listening to Radio Prague, the international service of Czech radio. I'm Pavla Horáková. Thanks for joining us on New Year's Eve. In today's show, David Vaughan talks to Jan Novák, a successful award-winning novelist and, among others, Miloš Forman's biographer. And later on in the show, a medley of 2011 stories in a special edition of magazine. Stay with us. When Jan Novák describes himself as Miloš Forman's autobiographer, he's not entirely joking. He really did co-write the most famous Czech-American film director's memoirs, and Forman himself has spoken of the book as My Life as Lived by Jan Novák. But Jan Novák is a great deal more than a biographer. He's best known for his hugely successful and award-winning novel So Far, So Good. Crossing the borders of documentary and fiction, the book tells the story of two brothers' dramatic escape from communist Czechoslovakia in 1953, the year when Novák was born. His novels and stories have also taken us below the surface of the Czech community in Chicago and into some of the less savory corners of corporate America. David Vaughan met Jan Novák in a Prague cafe to talk about his writing and his life on both sides of the Atlantic.
We're meeting here in a cafe, in a vaulted room, in one of the old gates of the fortifications of the city. Why did you choose for us to meet here?
Because I live around the corner from here.
So this is one of your local haunts.
It's convenient, and I don't really hang out here too much because they have fairly strange hours. It is actually a former gate in the fortifications in the direction of Písek, which I thought lies on the other side because we're on the north side of the castle, but somehow it's called Písecká brána, even though Písek is on the opposite side of Prague, so I like that paradox as well.
One of the many mysteries of Prague.
Right.
And on that subject, maybe we should go straight into a reading, because you've written a book, actually with a very unusual title, which you're going to tell us in a minute, which looks at many different aspects of Prague.
The book is called Commies, Crooks, Gypsies, Spooks, and Poets. And it's my adventure in the border zone of genre, because it combines elements of essays, autobiography, and travelogue, and centering on Prague, and basically describing the experiences we had here as a family in 1992-93, when I brought my American kids here, and we lived here as the communism was dying out.
So let's hear you read a short extract from the book.
The subtitle of the book is 13 Books of Prague in the Year of Great Lice Epidemic. And this excerpt is from the Guidebook of Prague. It breaks down to small chapters, which is something I do generally because I like to keep the purpose of each chapter or each piece of my text clear. So the book starts with a little chapter called Logic of Beauty. What makes a city? A river. And what makes a river? An old stone bridge. And what makes a bridge? Some hills to admire it from. And what makes the hills? A castle of ancient kings. Then there's applied logic of beauty, and there's all these legends, Prague. And finally, the whole book ends with a short chapter called Index. Prague was the place where Wolfgang Amadeus Mozart composed music, Albert Einstein taught physics, Franz Kafka adjudicated insurance claims, Rainer Maria Rilke wore the dresses of his dead sister, Jaroslav Hašek stole dogs, and Jaroslav Seifert stole kisses.
In those two little extracts that you've just been reading, you very clearly embracing these many layers of history in Prague. You were 16 when you and your parents emigrated just after the invasion of Czechoslovakia in 1968. Was it a shock going to America, where there isn't this sense of being surrounded by a history that goes back through the centuries in the way that there is in Prague?
We left 1 year after the invasion in 69, and we spent a year in Austria in a refugee camp, so there was a buffer. The time in the refugee camp was completely ahistorical, so in a way I was coming from a very ahistorical, radical situation into place that was just starting to wake up to history. America has changed tremendously in the 40 years that I've known it. You know, when I came to Chicago, there was hardly any decent theater and stuff. Eventually, 20 years later, I would be going to Steppenwolf Theater, where John Malkovich was just starting to get his acting chops, and there was a tremendous outburst, David Mamet, of creativity.
And a lot of teenagers who left Czechoslovakia after the 68 invasion virtually became Americans, didn't they? They turned their backs in many ways on their past in Czechoslovakia. You clearly didn't, because your first published book was actually written in Czech, albeit in a very particular type of Czech. Tell me a little bit about this first book that you wrote in the 1970s, at a time when presumably you didn't think that it would be read in Czechoslovakia.
The book is called Striptease Chicago, and I wrote it to make money. There was a contest at the University of Chicago, where I went to school, which paid $1,000 to the winning short story. So I'd been writing poetry until then. I wrote it in Czech and I translated it into English. I got a letter from Josef Škvorecký, who had started his publishing house, 68 Publishers in Toronto, saying that somebody had sent him my story and he liked what he read. He's asking me if I had more stories like that, that he would like to publish a book of stories of mine. So I sat down and wrote four more stories, which are kind of interconnected, so it has almost the feel of a novel, and he published it.
And it's interesting to be writing as a Czech, and in Czech, about a context that isn't Czech.
It was still pretty much Czech context. It was the Czech emigres. It was the way they spoke. The language is infested with English words. And so the dialogues in the book are written the way I heard people talking around me, but it's basically about Czechs. I've gone through a transformation as a writer, but I started out writing in Czech, about Czechs, for Czechs, and slowly I migrated all the way to a book, The Grand Life, which wasn't translated here, where I write in English about Americans, for Americans. And since then I've been backtracing, because now I'm here, and lately I've been writing in Czech, for Czechs, about Czechs.
I'd like to ask you about The Grand Life, the book that hasn't been translated into Czech, because, again, you can see there your fascination with language, because it looks with a great deal of irony at the language of the computer generation, the computer world, the jargon of the computer world.
I worked for 10 years for Illinois Bell as a supervisor in computer operations, and the book Grand Life is straight from that experience, and it is inspired by this kind of a nonsensical language around computers.
And you wrote that book in the 1980s. I mean, since then, society has gone a great deal farther at high speed in the direction of that kind of language becoming mainstream. It is gradually spreading into all aspects of life, isn't it?
That's true, and people now talk about rebooting their memories, and exactly the language that I used in the book is seeping into everyday discourse.
Are you frightened by that?
The speed is somewhat frightening to somebody who's getting older, but I think it's just a normal, you know, course of events.
A writer who has also shown a considerable interest in language and in what language does to us and in newspeak types of languages, Václav Havel, writing in a very different context of totalitarian Czechoslovakia, you actually adapted his play, The Garden Party, into an American context, didn't it? It became The Office Party. You took it out of a totalitarian context into the context of modern corporate America. Why did you do that? And how possible was it, given that you're no longer talking about a context which has the very specific characteristics of totalitarian control of information and also language by the state over the individual, which obviously, whatever you have in corporate America, you don't quite have that, do you?
Well, I think it's kind of nearing to, because of the efficiency of Big Brother in America as opposed to the inefficiency of the Big Brother here when the totalitarian pressure here was largest. There is now probably as much fear in like office people working in offices as there might have been back then when the state just wasn't that efficient at getting information. I just saw that the Marxist frame of reference that the Garden Party translation that I'd seen has was dated, and I thought the rest of the themes of the play, which I think it's a marvelous comedy.
Tell us a little bit about what the play is about, because probably many of our listeners won't have either seen or read it.
It's a play in the tradition of the theater of the absurd, where Havel himself says that the main character is the phrase. The characters are all these office people fighting these frog-mouse type of wars over information and stuff, and sucking up to their bosses and trying to hold on to their jobs within a company that it's not clear what it produces or what it's good for. It's basically about these relationships of people frightened by language and frightened by language is power, information is power. Everybody tries to attain as much information, keep hoarded for themselves, not give it on. And the relationships are defined by language and these informational power games. And it's very funny.
And I'd like to ask you about your cooperation with another of the Czech, I suppose, living legends. That's Miloš Forman. You're the co-author of his autobiography, if I can put it that way.
I am his autobiographer.
Is that how he puts it?
No, it's how I put it. But he says, it's my life as lived by Jan Novák, which is a bon mot, which kind of paradoxically sums up what it really is like to write this kind of a book with somebody who is fairly reticent about talking about his life like Forman is. You know, I had to kind of get all the facts about particular incidents in his life, but he wasn't used to talking about it in emotional terms like, you know, his childhood and stuff, so I wrote it almost as a novel. And Miloš eventually went over it and corrected whatever he corrected, very little, and it became a version of his life.
When his film One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest came out, it was a huge phenomenon in cinematography worldwide. But what probably most people in the American context don't know is the personal context of Miloš Forman. First of all, the trauma of the Second World War, and then his experiences of exile. Is this what you are trying to do in the book, to put his career as a film writer into the context of his life?
Well, I was trying to kind of basically describe his life from within somehow. He was trying to be a theater director and didn't make it. He failed a talent exam when he was applying, which blows my mind, you know, because he's lavishly talented. So he could have drifted off into the world of the theater and been consumed by it. So there are all these forks. At one point he had a nervous breakdown in a way, couldn't get out of bed for 3 months after his first American film failed, and there was a possibility still of going back to Czech Republic, which would have made a whole different life. So there are all these crossroads where he made certain decisions which determine how it is. So I was trying to show the flow of life, where you make decisions as you go along, and I wasn't standing back and looking at the totality of his life and seeing how different pieces fit together, because I know they were assembled haphazardly.
And do you have a favorite Miloš Forman film?
Yeah, I do. Loves of a Blonde.
Why is that?
It's perfect, I think. When I look at it these days, it's just, it looks like a documentary with a great story, great amusing scenes. I mean, there's not a syllable out of place in the way people talk. It just sounds completely like the world I grew up in. And it's got a really wonderful story of a girl working in a shoe factory in a town where the sexual gender composition is 14-1 in favor of women. And the army tries to correct it by placing a platoon of soldiers there, but they wind up being reservists and stuff, and there's a dance for the reservists, and this girl gets picked up by a piano player, and he kind of uses her and disappears, and she believes that he's in love with her and goes looking for him in Prague and winds up in his parents' apartment. So it's a very touching story of a girl looking for love, basically, and being used by the world because she's too naive and acquiring kind of a basic knowledge on how to navigate these existential straits.
Miloš Forman seems to have a soft spot for naivety, for people who are going to do their own thing, and naively. Do you share that kind of outlook on life? Because I have the feeling that you probably do.
What I keep finding in his work is this theme of an outsider looking in with his nose pressed to the glass into a world that really doesn't accept him, and somehow making a stand against it or within it, whether it's McMurphy and One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, whether it's The Blonde. Often there's a scene where somebody else is talking about one of the characters in their presence, in the third person, discussing their life in front of them in fairly disparaging terms. Miloš lost both of his parents to Germans, and from the age of 8, he was handed over from relative to relative and survived basically on the kindness of strangers, and probably heard his own situation discussed by other people in fairly derogatory terms in front of him, and just stuck with him. So that's one of the situations that keeps coming back. I think maybe that's not really my story psychologically. You know, I have different issues.
Your best known novel is So Far So Good. It tells a highly controversial story of a group of men who, at the height of the Stalinist regime here in Czechoslovakia, literally shot their way to freedom. The Machine Brothers, together with Milan Palma, and a group that had decided to take up arms against the regime. To this day, their story is highly controversial. What made you choose to tell that story?
It's an incredible story. It's an incredibly gripping adventure story of larger-than-life actions, such as, you know, I would be really excited to tell other people about. As soon as I heard about it, I was talking to people, listen, you got to read this. And I think I'm looking for signs of something arousing such an excitement in me, because I know then I'm going to write my best stuff about it.
Yeah. Opinions about the Machine Brothers are polarized, especially in this country. Those who see them as heroes, who are among the very few who are willing to take up arms against the new hardline communist order, and others who see them as opportunists who are willing to shoot innocent bystanders on the way to fighting their way out of Czechoslovakia. In your book, have you tried not to take one of those lines? Or would you say, as I suspect, that you probably sympathize more with those who would see them as heroes?
Well, in the book, I try to present their story in a neutral way. I'm leaving it up to the reader as much as possible. But in my mind, I'm very clear on the fact that they were totally justified in what they were doing. I think the highest value in human life is freedom. And a lot of the people who are kind of against them here, one, don't know all the facts of the situation. Two, have some sort of a guilt from some sort of a collaboration with the regime and stuff. But basically, to go back to their case, they fought the communists who were, by then, executing totally innocent people, were keeping everybody inside the country, running roughshod over the country, and who had declared class struggle until death, which they thought they would win. They were fighting this regime by the same means that their father employed in fighting the Germans, which meant that basically anybody wearing a uniform and strapping on a gun to protect this murderous regime is fair game. And they didn't kill any innocent bystanders. All the people that they killed were armed on behalf of this regime.
I have the feeling from what you're saying that you see this as a particularly sore point in Czech recent history and in the Czech psyche today, that this sort of heroism isn't acceptable, or isn't sort of considered by many people as acceptable in this country, because there are so few cases where people have done that in the last 50, 60 years.
Yeah, Czechs have a real problem with heroes. I agree completely with what you said, because the survival here was often predicated on dissimulation and pretending one thing and doing another thing in order to survive. Everybody, in a sense, is kind of implicated in this cultural way of reacting. Nothing is really head on. Everything is done by indirect means and stuff. So true heroes who meet things head on and wrestle with them head on are not appreciated.
And it's paradoxical, in a sense, isn't it, that you've gone from Czechoslovakia, the Czech Republic today, to America, where it's the exact opposite, isn't it? Everything's seen as far more clear-cut, which is probably the privilege of big nations, big countries, isn't it?
Yeah, and maybe I have been infected with it.
Another potential problem I see in this telling true stories through fiction is, of course, that where the historian is there gathering as many facts as possible and trying to process them, as a writer of fiction, if you run out of facts, nobody's going to complain if you invent a little bit to fill in the gaps. But the reader will be reading it as if it's a true story and won't necessarily recognize where the research ends and the imagination begins.
Obviously, there are two alternatives. You can write purely historical account, taking in all the facts that remain, which will give you a very small view on what happened, or you can try to reimagine it as it happened in time when it was happening, as a kind of a something passing through a consciousness that's recording it. There is no true version.
You're currently living in the Czech Republic again, and do you think you're here to stay? Are you happy here? And what are you working on?
I am happy here. I don't know if I'll stay here, because I live here while there's a tenant in my townhouse in Chicago who's paying my mortgage. And I'm living here with my daughter and my wife, and my son is in Chicago. I kind of miss America at times, but the life here is good at the moment. I have a bunch of projects here that I'm working on, so at the moment I'm happy here, but I don't know if I'll ever stay. I'm still paying taxes in America and stuff, and I'm here with only one foot, basically.
Do you feel a little bit of schizophrenia between Jan Novák, the Czech, and John Novák, the American?
Yes, definitely. And I think a lot of the emigres wind up in the schizophrenic position. But it's schizophrenic and enriching at the same time.
And are you writing something at the moment?
I'm shooting a documentary. It's about army hockey under communism. It's kind of a documentary comedy because the best teams in sports here were army teams. And what kind of soldiers were these guys who were the hockey players? What kind of officers were their coaches? You know, and what would they have done in case of war and stuff? So,
will that be completed at some time in the next few months?
Yeah, it's supposed to be completed by March, but I think probably I'll extend it by a couple of months, maybe by next summer.
Jan Novák, John Novák, thank you very much indeed for talking to Radio Prague.
Thank you.
Award-winning novelist Jan Novák there, talking to Radio Prague's David Vaughan in Prague's famous cafe Slavia. Now on Radio Prague, we continue with a special edition of Magazine 2012, bringing you a look at the lighter side of life in the past year. Not all marriages are made in heaven, it seems. A married couple from the town of Havličku v Brod recently made headlines when the bride got plastered and started a fight with a groom at their wedding reception. After physically attacking the groom and several relatives who tried to defend him, the bride unleashed her wrath on two police officers who were called to the scene when the fight spilled out onto the street. The officers were not amused and the bride was carted off in her wedding dress to spend her wedding night in a drunk tank. When she finally sobered up the next day, she was handed a hefty bill for the damage caused in the respective restaurant and the fee for her accommodation at the drunk tank. The media which reported the incident speculated about what the lady's divorce might look like if this was a taste of wedded bliss. Of course, if you want to get drunk, drink is not your only option. There are now bars in the Czech Republic offering cocktails in the form of a snack, for instance, a plate of alcoholic spaghetti. Given the fact that most visitors are still suspicious when faced with a drink on a plate, the special menu is something that you have to order in advance. For instance, at the Prague bar La Casa de la Havana, you can enjoy a four-course menu based on different alcoholic beverages, starting with crème de cassis with sparkling wine gelled into what appears to be a dish of caviar, followed by green peas Mary soup made of green peas, bacon and a dash of vodka. Then you can enjoy strawberry daiquiri a la Italiana, made of rum, strawberries, lime juice and sugar, gelled and pressed into pink spaghetti. And for dessert, nachos a la piña colada, made of pineapple, coconut, rum and cream. Just an idea for New Year's Eve. He's 35, the world's second best poker player, and has just won the equivalent of 98 million crowns. Moreover, ladies, he is single and unattached. Martin Staszko became an unlikely overnight hero when in his flannel shirt he played game after game and won second place at the World Poker Tournament in Las Vegas. Fears that the staggering financial prize might go to the young man's head were unfounded. On returning to Prague's Ruzyně Airport, he boarded a bus back home.
On being quizzed by the media about a girlfriend, Stashko said he had not had the time and opportunity to court anyone or had ever had a proper long-term relationship. "Maybe now the girls will find me," the unassuming young man quipped. "Well, I have a feeling they will, and they will doubtless be happy to teach him how to spend his money." She's a young communist and she's red hot. The 24-year-old town councillor from Jindřichův Hradec has put her town and party on the map by putting a series of nude pictures on her Facebook page. Vendula Kropová, an unabashed young communist, clearly has nothing to hide from her voters and ready to prove it with a series of nude pics where she is seen fishing, smoking a cigar and posing seductively on her bed. The scandal made headlines in the Czech Republic and Vendula's pictures appeared in tabloids across Europe. In The Sun, they came out under the heading, "Councillor gets her kit off to fish for votes." Fishing for votes is exactly what Vendula is doing, and she's not ashamed to admit it. As a guest on a popular talk show, the blonde councillor admitted she had not been assigned any specific work, but was still getting her bearings at the local town hall. Contrary to what you might expect, her party has not written her off. The chairman of the local Communist Party branch, Tomáš Vytiska, said that what the councillor did in her own private time and what she chose to put on her Facebook page was entirely her own affair. Besides, he added, "I haven't seen a single negative reaction to those pictures in Hradec." Well, a star is born. Maybe the Czech Republic will soon have its own Čičulína. Finally, an Ostrava brewer has produced the first ever Golden Brew, an exclusive brand of beer that literally contains particles of gold. Marek Pieton says he wanted to create a beer such as no one in the world had sampled and was inspired by the fact that Czechs call their beer liquid gold. "I decided it was time to produce a 24-carat brew for an exclusive clientele," Pieton said. Each of his beer bottles contains 0.017 to 0.018 grams of 24-carat gold that are so finely dispersed that they create a golden glitter. When you shake the beer bottle, you see gold particles swirling and dancing in the brew to create the impression of liquid gold. So far, the brewer has produced 60 bottles of the Golden Brew, labelled Faust, with the letters AU denoting gold. Some accuse him of snobbism, but Pieton is convinced that in spite of the economic crisis, there will always be clients looking for new and exclusive products, and he believes there is no one else in the world offering real golden beer. Well, that may be true enough, but he may have to look further afield for those clients. According to the latest surveys on New Year's resolutions among Czechs, the one that had been top of the list for years, to lose weight, has been replaced by a new goal, to reduce my household debts or to save more in the coming year. So it looks like for most Czechs it will be good old hops and malt in 2012.
Daniela Lazarová with Magazine, and I'm afraid that brings us to the end of today's program from Prague. You'll find us online at radio.cz. Should you like to contact us, our email address is english@radio.cz. This is Pavla Horáková wishing you the very best in the coming year.
vous écoutez Radio Prague.